Good afternoon, listeners. My name is Adam McNeil, your host of New Books in African American Studies. Today, we have the opportunity to hear from Dr. Eula Taylor, professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. And today, we're going to be talking to her about her recently published book in 2017, published by the University of North Carolina Press, called The Promise of Patriarchy, Women and the Nation of Islam. Good afternoon, Dr. Taylor. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Very good. And thank you once again for coming on to the channel this particular evening, afternoon. You know, you're out there in pretty Bay Area, California, and I'm in very dreary and cold Boston, Massachusetts. You know, so definitely welcome and thank you for coming on to the channel today. Yes. And so, yep. And I definitely thank you once again for coming on. And can you please, you know, we'd like to, before we get into the interview, really get into, you know, what got you to this project? So can you give us a little rundown on that, please?
Sure. This is a project that I've been thinking about for years. I wrote a book titled The Veiled Garvey, The Life and Times of Amy Jakes Garvey, which is an intellectual biography of Marcus Garvey's second wife. And what I learned in terms of writing that text was that after Marcus Garvey was deported from the United States in 1927, that in 1930, many former Garveyites actually went into what was initially called the Allah Temple of Islam that later became the Nation of Islam. So I was always curious about that. Then later on, I co-authored a book on the Black Panther Party. And in that book, I found out that many former members of the Nation of Islam, particularly during the height of COINTELPRO, went into the Nation of Islam. Some of them went to the Nation of Islam to hide and then found themselves staying in that movement. And so on both ends of my work, the Nation of Islam appeared. And then finally, when Spike Lee's film on Malcolm X came out, I remember I was a young assistant professor, and I was asked to be on a panel to have a conversation at the end of the film. And I knew, since I am a Black woman, that most likely any question about women in the movie would come directly to me. And so I ran to the library and tried to learn as much as I could about the experiences of women in the Nation of Islam. And I was actually shocked that there weren't any scholarly works. There were a lot of like pictorial histories, you know, pictures of them in Essence magazine, but nothing really giving them an academic intellectual treatment. And so all of this combined, wherein the Nation of Islam haunted me in a particular way, the experiences of women. And finally, I just said, you know what, I just need to dive into this.
And for sure, we're definitely happy here that you dove in head first into this project. And you know, as my mom would say, when it comes to food, you definitely put your foot in it.
I like your mom.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Sweet potato pie holiday time. It was a good one. Very good. Very good. And so thank you for that, you know, bit of your biography, because a lot of times we have, you know, academics and non-academics alike, you know, flocking to our channel. And we definitely want to know about, you know, what brought people to these, to the projects. And as a future PhD student in this next year, you know, you put your life into these projects. And so, you know, it's good to know a little bit about not only the actual things in the text, but what outside, you know, in the world brought you to these particular texts?
Well, I'm always been interested in the possibility of building a Black nation within a nation. And so, you know, my work on the Garvey movement, my work on the Black Panther Party and the Nation of Islam all speak to my fascination with Black nationalism, with Pan-African thought, to Black people trying to figure out, how do we do more than survive America? How do we create options and choices on our own terms? So this is why my work has largely been centered within Black nationalist and Pan-African movements.
You know, that has been a historical question and an organizing theme, you know, going back, you know, to the 19th century, even when you have, you know, different folks, you know, like Delaney and others who are doing such a thing, doing the same. And so this is definitely within a particular tradition that is greatly within the frame of the Nation of Islam. And so before we start, you know, getting into, you know, the tenets of the nation and Black nationalism as a whole within the context of this group and movement, can you give us a quick biography and kind of like a couple notes upon not only Black nationalism in the way that you see it, but also the Nation of Islam as a whole to give us like the quick kind of not necessarily a quick, but an origin story to this particular group?
Sure. The Nation of Islam, as we know it, is rooted in the Allah Temple of Islam. And the Allah Temple of Islam came into existence in Detroit in 1930 under the leadership of Farid Muhammad or Farah Muhammad, depending on how you want to pronounce his name. And as the story goes, he understood that many Black people who were migrating from the South right after World War I found themselves, on the one hand, seeking to find opportunities outside of the Jim Crow South, but then finding themselves in the Midwest and Northern and East Coast, still having to fight Jim Crow, perhaps a little bit differently, but Jim Crow nevertheless. And so he began to visit people's homes and eventually brought people together to think about, you know, what actually is the root of their oppression. And Farid Muhammad, along with other people during this time period, during the 1930s, the Great Depression, they were looking for religious answers to a lot of social and political and economic dislocation. So when the Allah Temple of Islam comes into existence in 1930, there are other kind of religious movements also happening. This is when you begin to see what today we would call Jehovah Witnesses going door to door during the 1930s. So there were a lot of religious groups coming into existence during the 30s, during the Great Depression. We can even think in our own lives, right? When things aren't going right, when it's like, could it get any worse? People who don't even identify themselves as religious or church-going people usually begin to pray. And so we see during this time period, many Black people looking for answers to how do you survive the Great Depression? And what Farid Muhammad was able to expose them to is that a lot of the Christianity that they were receiving in churches, you know, put a lot of the their joy in the afterlife, put a lot of their hopes in a future that that they couldn't visually see, and so he began to articulate that. You know, one didn't have to die to go to hell because they were living in hell. And so just to begin to, in many ways, he took the familiar in terms of Christianity and shifted the lens so that Black people could imagine a different religious possibility.
Wow, that's definitely so true, because as I was reading your text and as we were speaking offline, I definitely had really no clue about the particular history in depth of the nation. Actually, reverse that. I thought I knew about the nation, whether from watching Eyes on the Prize or reading, you know, or reading more about, you know, the autobiography Malcolm X has told Alex Haley, you know, in different texts, but. As I read this book and even talking to you in offline, I realized like, oh snap, man, that's not the truth. It's more so a half truth, if that. It's definitely not a full moon, and so full moon of truth that is. And so for me, reading this book and thinking about the particular history and even just the context of the Great Depression. Like we sometimes as historians and as lay people, we see these dates, but don't kind of look in depth to see the rest of the story of what else is happening within the confines of those dates, you know, in the interwar years and the later portion of the interwar years, especially.
Yes. Yeah, so when we look at, you know, the 1930s and the Great Depression and the ways in which Black people were suffering, in many ways, it provided an opportunity. When you're so desperate and you're suffering, you are willing to listen to a lot. You are willing to perhaps step out on faith in order to do more than survive the moment that you're living in. And many of the early converts to the Allah Temple of Islam, they were seeking an organization and they were seeking a religious way of life that would meet their needs where they were at. And that's what the Allah Temple of Islam did for them.
Right, absolutely. And so that particular history, when you talk about when people are at their lowest, they look up. And sometimes what they see, you know, not necessarily on top of them per se, but what they see as they look up is sometimes the quickest thing that they go to. And in many ways, they get enwrapped in it because it gives them a sense of belonging within a context, within an American nation that if the Great Depression is hitting, then what's happening to Black people, right? And so that particular lens you definitely see within this especially this origins story time frame of the nation in Detroit.
Yes, and I think what's also so interesting is that many of the early teachings of the Nation of Islam during the 1930s, it shifted how people were experiencing the Great Depression. For example, during the Great Depression, oftentimes we think of, you know, food lines, right? There are all kind of stories of children dying from malnutrition, right? People losing their appetite because they're eating like, you know, stale bread and water daily. And so what Fadl Muhammad did was he told people, you know what? Let's try to reduce our diet. So he encouraged his converts to eat one meal a day. And in eating one meal a day, he said, first of all, your body's not working overtime. Second of all, a lot of the illnesses that we have are connected to our diets. And so now with people eating once a day, their hunger pains that you might experience are no longer a sign of you actually being hungry, but could be a sign of you embracing a certain kind of discipline in your life.
And when you look at the dietary restrictions, really, that not only, as you say, the nation put upon their members, but also their connection to the actual economies, too, which is, I think the economic world that the nation builds, I think is one of the more fascinating parts about the entirety of their movement that we'll get to later on. But especially in this early period, and as you talk about the connection to the Depression. And so let's talk a bit about kind of the contours of the way that they practice being the nation, their workings of Islam, as you spoke about with the founding mosque or the founding group being the Allah Temple of Islam.
Yes, well, the Allah Temple of Islam, again, coming under the leadership of Fadl Muhammad, and the first temple is going to be in Detroit, the second one in Chicago. So we're talking about the Midwest. And in this organization, he imagined building believers, converts, who were willing to live within his vision of an Islamic life. And within his vision, there are a lot of dietary restrictions. And these dietary restrictions are obviously around pork and alcohol. There are a lot of restrictions on attire, a lot of restrictions on weight. A woman was not supposed to weigh over 120 pounds, a man over 115. It didn't matter how tall you were. And in many ways, the goal was to create a disciplined convert, a disciplined convert who would be a pure person who could receive his teachings of how he imagined Islam. It's during this time period, the 30s, and pretty much up until World War II, that it's very, very difficult to get at a lot of the teachings, because what we know about the Nation of Islam largely becomes a post-World War II phenomenon, if you will. And that's when Elijah Muhammad moves center, and his faction of the Nation of Islam moves to the center and eventually has the most converts. But during the 1930s, when we look at under Fadl Muhammad, and we're talking about from 1930 to 1934, his understanding of creating an Islamic community is one wherein converts go and listen to him preach or provide lessons. He is presenting lessons that underscore and anchor his truth about Black people and his truth about white people. And within this truth, white people are understood as devils because of their devilish behavior, because of the way in which race had put Black people in a state of being oppressed, particularly under Jim Crow laws. And within this, he told Black people that, you know what, you have to do for self. You have to figure out how do you create opportunity for yourself wherein you are not dependent upon anyone else for your own family. So in the 30s, one of the few things that we have from that period about those early converts was something called the Dillon Report. And I located the Dillon Report at the local library in Detroit, Michigan. And up until the point, I had never seen it in print. And the Dillon Report was a report done by the Welfare Department in Detroit. Because of the Great Depression, you had many, many people on the dole, meaning that they were receiving welfare. And because of being, because people were on the dole or receiving welfare, they would have what today we would call a welfare agent, if you will, someone who would monitor their behavior, someone who would ensure that they were living within the rules. And so because many of the members of the organization were taking their children out of public school in order to enroll them in the Allah Temple of Islam school, the school began to report to the welfare agencies that these members were taking their children out of school. So this is how we begin to have an archival record on those early Muslim families, because they took their children out of public school. And so the welfare department comes in through the attendance office. And so they begin to go in and they look at the behavior of what these parents are, how these parents are living, why they're taking their children out of school, and what this school looks like. And it's through this document that we're able to get at least a small lens on the early converts of the Allah Temple of Islam members. And here we find out that many of them refuse to eat where the where they're supposed to eat in the quote welfare kitchen because of the food that's being served. Here we see that many of them refuse to send their children to particular camps because they see themselves as not a part of that particular quote-unquote Negro group. They see themselves as superior to them, if you will, in their understanding of themselves. And it's here that we get a lot of details about the early lives of these converts in Detroit and how they were determined not to send their children to public schools because of the way in which Jim Crow functioned and operated, wherein their children were taught that they were less than who their parents knew them to be.
And that story goes into, you know, Black self-sufficiency, Black education, Black removal from, you know, forms of public education because of really the lack of Black stories, for instance, which, well, still a story today. But, you know, these aspects are all, you know, within a traditional line. And so, you know, learning about this particular history, and also not only how, because as you talked about when, how you came to these particular documents, also tells a story of not only how the nation was building, but also what were people around them, Black and white, you know, governmental and non-governmental groups, how did they interact and how did they think about the nation as it was building? Because America's had an interesting relationship with Islam, dating back all the way to enslavement and even Jefferson having copies of the Quran and different things like that. And so America's had a rough and weird history, a very combative history when it comes to Islam. And this particular story that you talk about definitely shows that.
Well, you're absolutely right, especially when you look at other Black folks in Detroit. Many of the leaders in Detroit, members of the Urban League, members of the NAACP, they were deeply concerned about the Allah Temple of Islam. They were deeply concerned about how they believed that these converts were being duped, if you will, that these converts were being led astray. And so what we see happening is that many of them believe that it was that the fact that the Allah Temple of Islam could take hold in Detroit and convert as many as 8,000 people there, they saw it as a shortcoming of their own leadership, that they had not tapped into working class and underclass people and offered them support in the ways that they should. And so they were concerned about it. They were concerned about them, quote, unquote, being led astray. They were concerned about them being under the wrong influence.
You're definitely right. That was an important aspect of the book that I definitely, it was very interesting to read about. Because as I said before, a lot, as you said, a lot of the history that we know of the nation is a nation in almost the 1950s, or almost the time, you know, the late 1940s, 1950s, as Malcolm Little and later Malcolm X is getting out of jail in Massachusetts and such like that. And so throughout this entire frame, you know, we're talking about the early influencers and the creators of the nation. But the stories about women like, the wife of Elijah Muhammad, Clara Poole, Muhammad before, I mean, excuse me, after, and others are, they're ones where they are the ones who are making inroads within the nation and really defining and helping to redefine what Black womanhood is within the frame of what became, you know, the Nation of Islam.
Yes. The first chapter of the book is really, really focused on Clara Poole, who will become Clara Muhammad, because I point out how it's really largely through her that she encourages her husband to accept his own leadership in the organization. And a lot of it was largely because of her own frustrations during the Great Depression, and how Elijah Poole at the time had difficulty holding a job, was drinking, would gamble the money away. They had small children, and she was trying to figure out, how can I make him responsible to this family? And because of her sister-in-law and Elijah Poole's brother, who had been going to hear Farah speak, that they encouraged her to come. And she went, and she liked a lot of what he was saying. And a lot of what he was saying was that he was encouraging those Black people in the audience to understand that they were, quote, quote, the original man, right? That they were the cream, that they were not what Jim Crow was trying to get them to digest and understand, that they were second class anything. She was encouraged by it, and she knew her husband would be encouraged by it. And at one time, she went to one of the lectures, and it's reported that he asked, you know, where's the man that lives in Hamtramck? And this is where they lived. And she acknowledged and said, you know, he is my husband. And it's reported that he said, tell him to continue to do what he's doing, and I'll back him in what he did. And she allegedly reported this to Elijah, and clearly he needed to hear that more than anybody. And it transformed him in terms of understanding who he was and who he could be.
Right. And that, to me, it's just one of those stories of, you know, as we see so many times in our history as Black people, when you have someone encouraging you, when someone believes in you more than really you believe in yourself, and then, you know, that's really how a lot of people have dragged themselves out of the ditches of life, is that the words and the actions of others on your particular behalf emboldens you to do and produce greatness. And, you know, Elijah Muhammad is a testament of that because of his wife. And in many ways, there is no Nation of Islam, at least in the way that we know it to be, unless there is a Clara Poole, also Clara Muhammad. And I don't think that's definitely an understatement. I don't think that's a grandiose statement to make.
Absolutely. Between Clara Poole, along with other women that I tried to recenter in this story, women like the secretary of Farah Muhammad, who was Sister Bernstein, who I highlight in the book. Other women who were very, very active during World War II. So whether we're talking about reformer Bernstein Sharif, who was actually the secretary to Farah Muhammad, right? Her role in helping to maintain this organization, right? Her role in ensuring that people were registering to be a part of this organization is lifted from the ashes and centered into the book. When we look at World War II, and in terms of the role of Sister Clara, you know, I also introduced other women who were very, very important to helping to shift the Allah Temple of Islam from into the Nation of Islam. Sister Pauline Bahar, who in many ways kept the organization going during World War II, when most of the men were incarcerated because they refused to go to World War II. So I tried to introduce new voices who have fallen outside of our understanding of the early history of the Nation of Islam.
And I really appreciate that, because as you know, as I said before, and I've probably said two or three times by now, I didn't know about a lot of these women. And so I definitely appreciate that. And also for our listeners, just to make sure you know exactly what we're talking about here, I'm speaking to Dr. Eula Taylor at the University of California at Berkeley, whose book published very recently through the University of North Carolina Press, most importantly, The Promise of Patriarchy, Women in the Nation of Islam. And so this particular book is great because we've already learned so much about the centrality of Black women in the creation of this great group, but more importantly, understanding also kind of how we haven't learned about them. And so this is, if anything, a reclamation project and really re-energizing our understanding of the nation. And it's one of the more important groups of the entirety of the 20th century. And so definitely appreciate once again the work that you put in for this, Dr. Taylor.
Thank you so much. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about the Nation of Islam is that oftentimes we think about it exclusively in the terms of Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad because they were so central and important to it. And for me, I kind of wanted to go backwards and also move forward. So this is why those early voices like Clara Muhammad and Bernstein, Sharif and Pauline Bahara and Sister Thelma X are important. But I also wanted to move forward too, because I think one of the things that's so interesting about the Nation of Islam is that some people were in the Nation of Islam for a couple of months. Some people were in for years. Some people were in for, you know, a lifetime. But a lot of people had an experience in it, particularly in the 60s. So, and that's one of the things that I try to point out in the book, is that people like James Etta X, popularly known as Etta James, had a short period in the nation in 1960. People like Sonia Sanchez of the arts movement was in the nation, you know, in the early 70s. So I wanted to kind of combine both people who could be identified as rank and file, people who, you know, were not sister captains, people whose husbands were not higher up in terms of the structure of the nation, to kind of understand what is it like to be a rank and file member of this movement, along with people who were in positions of structural power. So I tried to offer a balance of those experiences.
And that's great, because a lot of times we hear about these particular important figures, like you said, Etta James and Sonia Sanchez and others. And, you know, it's an organization, being the nation, that especially if you're in the urban north and out west, is very influential. And as it gleans down more downward toward the south, though, you know, Atlanta historically has had a temple, a mosque there, it just spreads. And so you come into contact with people, and even though you may not be a member of the nation, you will come into contact with them. And in many ways, they're very influential people.
Absolutely. And I have to say, Atlanta for a long time was the only mosque in the South.
Right. And that was something that I didn't even think about as well. And so, you know, prior to my talking about the title of your book and such like that, and brief bit of your bio, you spoke about the incarceration during World War II. And so if we can kind of turn back there real quick, because something that was interesting for me was learning about even the incarceration and what that did for some of the women who were actually incarcerated themselves.
Yes, well, we have women who were incarcerated, spent short period, well, 30 days in jail in Chicago, for example, during the 1930s. So that's where I was able to document women actually being in jail. For the World War II period, only one woman, Sister Pauline Bahara, was indicted for sedition. But she was not incarcerated the way in which Elijah Muhammad and at least 100 other men were incarcerated because of their refusal to go to World War II. But what I point out in terms of incarceration, whether it's the 1930s, is that oftentimes we think about, oh, people going to jail for 30 days as if that's just something easy. And it's not, just the way it's not easy to go to jail for longer periods of time. So I, for the time period that they are doing time in Cook County Jail, I go through and I point out how during the 1930s, when you were incarcerated, not only, you know, were you forced to sleep on sheets that other people had slept on, but, you know, there was a lot of contagion in the prison, how oftentimes many people who were in prison, if they were like, it was supposed to hold five people, they might have 15 people in that one cell. And so the conditions were horrible. Fast forward to World War II, one of the things that I point out is that when Elijah Muhammad and the other men were incarcerated, that women kept the movement going. And I point out how I believe that it's during this period that not only does the Honorable Elijah Muhammad see the importance of organizing and pulling people who are incarcerated into his movement, but the women also begin to see the importance of literacy, that is actually writing letters, wherein we often think about, you know, quote, quote, fishing or bringing members into the organization as being exclusively people being on the corners, men being on the corners and pulling people in. But I point out how women are actually writing letters to men who are incarcerated, and that becomes a way in which they are, quote, quote, fishing for new members.
And that's important because, you know, you hear these stories in different contexts of women on the home front holding down, you know, whether within the confines of employment or within this context of keeping a nation literally together. Women are at the forefront of that. And once again, if you don't have women like Clara Muhammad and the women who kept the nation going within the frame of the incarceration of many of the leaders, of male leaders, that is, of the organization, of the nation, then you don't have, you can't reach Malcolm. You can't reach the other people once the nation pushes towards like a prison ministry or prison outreach that they have in the latter 40s and such.
It's interesting because in addition to conducting research in Detroit, where I found the Dillon Report, I also conducted research in New York at the Schomburg Library. As most of you know, that they have the Malcolm X archive there. And I was able to find a letter that Malcolm X wrote wherein he pointed out how he was chastising the brothers because they were saying, you know, the women are sending out more letters than the men. And so the whole idea of, and I think this is so important, of literacy at this time period, in order to become a member of the Nation of Islam, you had to be able to write a letter, right? You had to be able to replicate a letter. Replicated in terms of not just spelling, but in terms of just how one, and penmanship. And literacy, some people learned to read and write because they wanted to be a member, because it was required for membership. And so I think it's just oftentimes those are the quote, quote, small things that fall out of discussion and conversation around membership. And I think it's just so very, very important, the role of literacy and not only allowing one to be a member, but as well as pulling other people into membership.
Right. And I think, you know, that is so important because, as we talked about before, within the context of Clara Poole pulling Elijah out of the little sometimes drunken stupors that he would be under, the nation, the rise of this particular group gave him something to not only look forward to, but to work into. And the same thing qualifies here as well. So that's definitely important, because if you're imprisoned, you know, I've never been in prison, but I can only imagine that you need something to help you to stay sane so that you can reach the time at which your duration and within imprisonment is over. And what they're able to do is keep people alive in many ways. Yeah, because you see sometimes when someone's been married 50 or 60 years, you see one of them die, and then within the next day or two, the other one dies too, because they feel like potentially their person is gone. There might be anything to live for. They want to be with them in heaven, for instance. And so within this context, you know, they wanted to be able to get out of the hell that is within imprisonment. And that potential heaven was, you know, the nation.
And in writing too, I talk about writing as a way in which to not only fish pull people in the organization, but it also becomes a way for the women who are actually writing to reaffirm why they are committed to the organization, right? So in that, they're talking about, you know, how their life was prior to their membership, what their life is like now since they are a member of the Nation of Islam. So I talk about just the whole writing process itself as a way in which to reaffirm your own commitment to the organization.
When I think about literacy and the importance of literacy, this, you know, the nation, you know, made it very, as you greatly said, you know, the nation made it very important that writing and literacy was so important. And so it's great to really learn about this, because once again, I had no clue about this. And so my eyes are very much open, and I'm glad about it. Going, you know, a little bit further into the book, you know, can we talk about, you know, that pivotal time, you know, within the 1950s, pushing towards the 1960s, when the rise of the nation nationally really begins to go, it really gets cranking up. So would we be able to talk about the women that were very integral to that particular time frame and that particular process?
Sure. It's very interesting, because when we look at the Nation of Islam after World War II, first of all, I would like to say that it's really during World War II that we have something called the Nation of Islam. At this point, it's really, really clear that we have this transition from the Allah Temple of Islam into the Nation of Islam. I wasn't able to, like, you know, pinpoint the exact day, but it's definitely during this period that we see this transition. And we also see a transition wherein Elijah Muhammad, who is going to be centered in Chicago, and where his version of the Nation of Islam is going to blossom. And I say that because in Detroit, there were other people who were leading their version of the Nation of Islam at that time as well. So during the World War II period, again, I talked a little bit about why I introduced a woman named Pauline Bahar, who is very, very interesting in terms of keeping the Nation of Islam going, in terms of the women continue to meet. They're meeting in homes. They are forced to defend themselves verbally when people on the streets are critiquing what they're wearing and what they were wearing were their uniforms. And those uniforms in many ways look like those uniforms that the Black Cross nurses of the Garvey movement wore during the 1920s. And so when we get to the 1950s, this is where Minister Malcolm X definitely moves to center stage. And it's during this time period where we begin to see nation women flexing their womanhood in a lot of different ways. And I document how women are understanding and being trained in the teachings of the Nation of Islam through the Muslim Girls Training and General Civilization class, the MGTGCC. So at this time, when we're talking about, by 1955, there were about, I think there were 15 temples in the United States, but by 1959, there were over 50. So this is where we really, really do see just the blossoming, right, of this movement. Again, so 1955, we have about 15, 1959, they're over 50. So this is when it truly, truly expands. And it's expanding. We're in the MGT. Women learn their roles in the organization and men learn their roles in the organization through the FOI, the Fruit of Islam. And it's during this time period that a woman named Sister Thelma X moves into the center for me. And Sister Thelma X, I was able to locate her very, very slim archive, if you will, at it was Howard University, the the C. Eric Lincoln papers. And she wrote, I don't know how many versions of this she was able to produce, but in the C. Eric Lincoln papers, there is a small newsletter, if you will, that you could describe it as that called Truth, that she was the author of. And in it, she basically pointed out why one would want to join the Nation of Islam. And she talked about how Elijah Muhammad was her leader and teacher. She talked about the critique of integration. She had articles such as An Asiatic Grandmother Speaks for the Negro Children, and she offered her solution to the Little Rock problem of integration. And she posed questions such as, what good is your son's diploma hanging on the wall while he is hanging on the limb of a tree? So she pointed out, what Jim Crow actually offered Black people, and how the only ways in which Black people would be able to live and be their full selves were if they were deeply committed to creating their own nation. And she talked about how integration in schools was not the way for Black people to move forward. She basically was very, very critical of integration or desegregation, because she believed that it was putting children in harm's way. She believed that that the Nation of Islam schooling was the proper way to educate Black people to know who they were and who they could possibly become. So she was very, very critical of the direction of the NAACP at the time. And she was very, very critical of the leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And so I point out her very slim archive, but important archive for the 50s. I also point out that there were women like Sister Louise Dunlap and Sister Ernestine Scott, women who have completely fallen out of the Nation of Islam's history. But these are women who, sat in a white-only railroad station and who were confronted by a police officer who, because of their willingness to sit in a white-only section of the railroad station, eventually two men who were members of the Nation of Islam come to their defense. And these men engage in a confrontation with that police officer. And in the end, because of their willingness to defend those two women, they find themselves in jail. And then Minister Malcolm X is forced to go and bail them out of jail. And the story enters into the history of the Nation of Islam, largely because of the men going to jail and Malcolm X having to bail them out. But the fact of the matter is, it all began with these two women taking the position that they could sit wherever they wanted to. And so I introduced them into the 1950s. And finally, for the 50s, I introduce Sister Betty X, who would eventually become the wife of Minister Malcolm X. But what I do around Betty X is that oftentimes people talk about Betty's conversion into the Nation of Islam, but I actually begin with the woman who Betty simply describes as a nurse's aide at the hospital who actually invited her to dinner and eventually to the temple. And I talk about this unnamed woman as a woman who is actually fishing for women like Sister Betty. And so, although I don't have her name, I talk about how Betty describes her interaction with her and how she's constantly encouraging her to come back to the temple to hear her minister, who at that time was Minister Malcolm X.
And that's huge. And I appreciate you doing that, because a lot of times when we think about Sister Betty, it's always about her attached to Minister Malcolm, you know, and then going into marriage. But it's good to hear and to learn about how did she get into the Nation, and what was her story about her coming into it, because she is such an important figure today. And obviously, you know, it's always good to know, especially in the context of learning and writing about Black women, about them, about their lives, and whether or not attached to somebody else, right? They're living their lives and they're doing their thing. And then, you know, how do they come into their, how do they build themselves up effectively? And so I definitely appreciate you doing that, especially in this particular context.
Yes, one of the things that I really tried to put forward in this book is that, and the reason why I titled it The Promise of Patriarchy is because I want people to understand that the concept of patriarchy, right? This whole idea that women, if you are a part of this organization, that there are going to be some things that are going to be beneficial for you. You're going to have the choice of not having to work outside the home. And during the 50s, this meant you're going to have the choice of not having to work as a domestic, because most of the women during the 1950s who are Black, who are not formally educated, they are working as some form of a domestic. And there was no guarantee that you would have a better experience working as a domestic in a white person's home than being a wife in a patriarchal home. And so I point out how oftentimes we go to all of the troubling and problematic nature of patriarchy, that is oppression and domination. And definitely women in the Nation of Islam walked that tight rope, and that how do I live with someone who technically has the final say, wherein I am not oppressed, wherein I am not dominated, wherein I am heard. And so having to walk that tightrope became difficult for some women. But if you were able to achieve a healthy balance of respect and protection and trust, then it could be a home wherein a woman would be shielded from all of the violence of Jim Crow life.
And that's so true, because, you know, when you think about, you know, how people might characterize women within the Nation as not having, you know, quote unquote agency and these different things, it's much more complicated than that. And really, that's the one of the more important interventions that your book makes, is to complicate that particular narrative when it came to women within the actual Nation, and that they produced greatness within the Nation. And so, you know, it's not taking away from what the actual realities of that were on a daily basis, but it's very important that we hear about their contributions, and not only contributions, because those could be peripheral, but their central workings within the organization, or within the actual Nation, excuse me.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I really, really did my best to to anchor in this book is that how one experienced the Nation of Islam in 1930 would be different from how you experienced it in 40 versus 50, 60, and 70. Because a lot of times when people write about how women are experiencing Black nationalist or patriarchal movements, it is as if they're not experiencing history. And I wanted to point out, you know, the Great Depression, you're going to have a certain kind of experience in the nation versus the 1950s when we have, you know, suburban life coming into existence, where you have a lot of Black women still being forced to work as domestics. You're going to experience the nation in a particular way versus the 1960s when we begin to have more options and choices about building a Black nation and what that could look like versus the 1970s when we have the women's movement, right? And how Black women are experiencing Black feminism and different kind of options, and how even under those conditions, people still might find themselves going back into the nation because of what they experienced in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, what they experienced in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, what they experienced even in the women's movement.
Right. And that's an important breakdown, because when you look at, you know, how the nation grows within the 60s and you have so many things that are going on, that yes, you are building this nation, but it's not isolated so much from what is going on and the contours of the actual nation that your nation is within. Realizing that, for me, it was important because all of, you know, it's not, you know, women within the Nation of Islam, they were not separated from this, right? They were affected and influenced, hence why some of them left and went into these other groups and different movements. And then, as you say, ultimately came back and they had different experiences that brought them back, but nevertheless, they did decide to come back. And I think that's an important a piece that, once again, I had no clue about.
Yes, the Nation of Islam, I was giving a talk last week in D.C., and I was asked a question about, what about the second and third generation of people who are a part of the Nation of Islam? How are they experiencing? I thought it was a great question, because one of the things that I do in the book, I talk about coming of age in the nation. I talk about how there were people born in the nation or people who were raised in the nation. So, for example, Muhammad Ali's second wife, Belinda Boyd, who becomes Khalilah Ali, she was raised in the nation. She had a longer history in the Nation of Islam than Muhammad Ali himself. And so how she experienced the nation would be different from how her parents experienced it, and then later on their own children. And so I think it's important to understand that because the Nation of Islam has a history, you have second and third generation people being born and raised, going in and out of it, the way in which you have second and third generation people being children of preachers, right, and ministers, and parts of different Christian denominations going in and out of the church.
As I know for sure, you know what's important for me, and part of the reason why for me the nation is actually very important, though I never was never a member, was, you know, when I'm reading, when I'm reading about, you know, Malcolm and reading his autobiography, it was at a very pivotal time in my life. And when I was first about to start graduate school, and I read that book, and it made me think like, oh snap, man, this brother here, Malcolm, he's reciting, you know, poetically from the Bible. And I'm like, shoot, I need to set my game up. I say I'm this, but I need to, you know, all right, Malcolm, you're motivating me, my brother. And so, you know, we all go in and out of these different traditions, and sometimes anyway, and there are things that bring in and there are things that bring out. But telling that particular story of the deviations and the comebacks are very important. And it's also why it brings us even to the 70s and the 80s as well within the nation, as, you know, as Minister Louis Farrakhan is, you know, building up, and then these other factions are building up too after the death of Elijah Muhammad in the early 70s.
Yes, I think it's important at this time, perhaps, to say that how a person experienced the Nation of Islam largely had to do with where you were actually living. You know, the mosque, who was your minister of your mosque, who was your brother captain, who was your sister captain, because they're setting the tone for the mosque itself. And I say that because just the way in which you could experience the Black Panther Party in Oakland different from how you might experience it in Los Angeles versus how you experienced it in New York or Seattle, the Nation of Islam is comparable. And so this is why, in many ways, I'm looking at the period between 1930 and 1975, but how you experienced it largely had to do with where you were at and who were the leaders of your particular mosque. And so when you get into the post-1975 period, where you have a lot of different factions coming into existence, how you experience that had a lot to do with the teachings of the leader in that particular group and where you were physically living. And in the book, I interviewed people who had experienced the Nation of Islam in the Midwest, in California, in on the East Coast. But what I tried to do is I tried to listen to all of their stories to figure out, you know, what are some of the common elements of it in order to write this history. Because I definitely understand that people are going to experience it, you know, based on the people that are around them.
Right. And thank you for that. I appreciate that, because you are right. How you experience something is not uniform to the actual, you know, group that you profess that you're a part of, right? And definitely see that painted throughout. And so, you know, when you talk even about, you know, what's going on in the 70s and such like that, and like you said, it's mostly towards, you know, the mid 70s and such like that. But also your epilogue and your conclusion were very important for me in understanding, you know, you talk about the particular contours of the group of the nation as you move towards the end of the 20th and going into the 21st century as well, with the ode to the 80s too. And so that time was, I think, very important, because that's also a time where, you know, how I came to understand the nation as well started to get painted too. As a lot of us, you know, you have these, you know, I'm sure you've seen it, that picture, that black backgrounded picture where you have, you have the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, was it maybe Malcolm X and King and everybody in the background, right? And so that's you know where I started to really like, who is that guy? Oh, it's a you know, it's a Elijah Muhammad. So
yeah. So you're absolutely right. So when Elijah Muhammad died, I think it was February 25th, 1975. It's important to say so did his Nation of Islam. And so upon his death, his children, whom at that time were identified as the royal family, they proclaimed that Wallace D. Muhammad, who was the seventh child of Clara and Elijah Muhammad, would become the new leader of the organization. And within 6 months, Wallace Muhammad, he revised a lot of his father's Islamic teachings, particularly the teaching that depicted whites as devils. In fact, it was under Wallace Muhammad that we have the first white person become a part of the Nation of Islam in terms of conversion. And many of the people who had who were, quote, the original followers of Elijah Muhammad under what became known as the original Nation of Islam, did not like the direction that Wallace Muhammad was going, and they began to break off. And so in the epilogue, I identify three of these branches, Silas Muhammad in Atlanta, Yusuf Bey in Oakland, and Louis Farrakhan, which had the largest number of converts. And this was actually a very difficult story to tell, largely because of what happened in Oakland, California, under the leadership of Yusuf Bey. But I concluded by pointing out that that it's in the post-1975 period that you still have people doing their best to figure out, how am I going to be able to do more than survive America? So white supremacy, racial violence, police brutality, poverty, poor schooling, the high incarceration of Black folks, right? These were the things that spurred people to join the Nation in 1930. And so clearly, those same conditions are the reason why people continue to join this organization, you know, in the present moment. And in the end, my last two words in the book are, I understand, because I do, in terms of when you are living in an environment where there is, you know, so much anti-Black rhetoric and harm being articulated, people are looking for a place, a way in which to navigate all of this. And the Nation of Islam has become a site for some.
And that is very important. And it's also, you know, in the last couple of minutes that we have you, it's definitely important that, you know, you put that final aspect of it with your epilogue, because the Nation is, you know, it's one of the great organizations, you know, it's one of the great movements and the great groups of the 20th century. It's also one of the most controversial too. And so trying to understand the Nation is something that's also very important too. And so when you say, I understand, as far as, you know, the yearning to create a nation and the frames and the direction that they took to do it, I understand as well. And hopefully our listeners better understand, and we'll go and get that book. And so that book being The Promise of Patriarchy, Women and the Nation of Islam. And in the last, like I said, in the last couple of minutes, you know, it takes a lot to write these books, and it takes a lot of different kinds of energy, shall we say. But with that said, is there anything that you're working on that you can give us a little, you know, brief synopsis about, if possible, or anything else that you got going on within your writing life?
Sure. I think for most scholars, one of the ways to put closure on one project is to begin another. And so I was able to put closure on The Promise of Patriarchy by beginning a new project on a woman named Frances Beale. Frances Beale was a member of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a founding member of the Third World Women's Alliance, which in many ways became it became the anchor for our understanding of women of color feminism, for Black feminism. So the Third World Women's Alliance, for example, was very, very active in the 70s in support of Angela Davis. Frances Beale herself wrote a wonderful, wonderful essay in the late 60s called Double Jeopardy, to be Black and female in the movement. So I'm really, really interested in Frances Beale as an activist of the 60s, but most importantly, how she as a radical activist continue to live a life committed to freedom. So in the 60s, she's a part of SNCC. In the 70s, she's a part of the Third World Women's Alliance. During the 80s, she's a part of the apartheid movement. And she goes to South Africa to be a part of witnessing the election process. And if you fast forward, she was very, very active in the Black Radical Congress. In fact, she was the national secretary. So I'm interested in her life because in many ways, it's the life of a Black radical. And I'm interested in how someone can remain committed to freedom, to liberation, and to be able to live and witness and observe so much change and to continue to reignite her commitment every step of the way. And what are those lessons that we can apply for us today to give us courage and energy and a certain kind of resilience to do more?
And we definitely appreciate you for taking this, for you to take the initiative to do more. And hopefully once you complete that project, we'll get you back on the channel for sure.
I would be honored.
Very good. So once again, we have Dr. Eula Taylor, professor of African American Studies at University of California at Berkeley. And we've been talking to her today about her recent book from the University of North Carolina Press entitled The Promise of Patriarchy, Women and the Nation of Islam,